get back to the agenda. So, Kevin, you're going to do a bounty update, I think, right?
Mr. Chairman, I'm actually going to have Keith Fisk present a few slides on the bounty program. He's been implementing the bounty administratively, and I'd like him to cover a few of those things. So,
okay. Keith, are you ready?
Sure am. Chris, if you could pull up that presentation, I got about 7 slides for folks. Oh, yeah, here he comes. All right, folks, if you guys recall back at, Keith Fisk, I'm the Wildlife Damage Program Administrator with Game Fish and Parks. If you folks recall back at your March meeting, that's when you folks passed a resolution that put in place several different parameters for the 2020 Nest Predator Bounty Program. Few changes from the previous year we made. We opened it to hunting and trapping. We decreased the bounty payment for the per tail basis, if you recall, from 10 to 5, and then also tweaked the start and the end dates and the total dollars that we were going to allocate for the bounty program. Next slide, Chris. So the program objectives, I'm not going to read all those. I'm going to touch base a couple of them. First and foremost, it was to enhance pheasant and duck nest success, and then also get people into the outdoors, get those people exposed that perhaps hadn't been exposed in the past, and then ensure that that rich hunting and trapping tradition that we have here in South Dakota continues on for the next 100 years. Through the survey that we shared with you folks back this past spring through responsive management, a high percent of the folks that participated and random residents of South Dakota also wanted to see a large number of predators reduced. And then I kind of touched base already on that, getting the next generation involved, and with the end goal there of getting a broader base of individuals that support for habitat, just like we see in our outdoor campuses, kids that come into those programs, they're exposed to an activity once, and they may not participate immediately, but sometime in their life, they're going to come back to those experiences and hopefully in a positive manner and be able to have that broad base of support for habitat in particular. Chris? Yeah, so this 2020 program ran from April 1st, and it was either going to run through July 1st, or if we hit a $250,000 cap, the program did run through July 1st this past year. Due to COVID-19, we weren't able to accept tails right away at the start. COVID-19 hit probably around mid-March, which impacted our offices being shut down. And we did a lot of media work and asked people to go ahead and freeze those tails until offices were open. We started to take tails at a select number of offices. I think the first check-in day was about May 7th. And then we really didn't start to open our offices on a regular basis for those tail check-ins till about the first part of June. But in total this past year, we took a little over 26,000 tails in submissions, and you can see the breakdown there for trapping and hunting. By far and large, the majority were trapping, taken by trapping. And then you can see the breakdown there on that table to the right. So again, similar to last year, the majority of those critters that were submitted for raccoon, and then followed up with striped skunk and opossum, and just a few of those other nest predators, red fox and badger, for again a total of just over 26,000. The top 5 counties in South Dakota you can see there. And then Chris, if you go to the next slide, I think we have a map. Yeah, so this map is a map of where the higher submissions came from, and you can see the areas of in red, orange and yellow are those higher submission counties. And you can clearly see the eastern one-third, I would say, of South Dakota had the largest number of submissions here in the state. Next slide. So some quick statistics on the program. This past year, we had just over 1,100 participants. 93 of those individuals were from eastern South Dakota. And out of those 1,100 participants, roughly about half of them participated in the program the previous year. And then I also wanted to share some information on the age demographics. So the participants' age this year ranged from 5 to 90 years old. And then if you look at that chart there at the bottom, you can see how we have those ages broke out and the percent of participants. And if you recall, on the resolution that you folks passed, we had about three or four different goals. And one of the goals that we had outlined there was to increase the youth participation with individuals in that lowest category. I believe last year we were at around 13%. We wanted to boost that to 20, made it up to 16%. But if you look through those age categories, shouldn't be anyone surprised that the largest participants there were that 51 to 70 year olds. Just like we see with all of our other hunting seasons, it's kind of those baby boomers, the people that got involved in hunting, and that makes up the largest segment of our hunting population, which shouldn't be a surprise to anybody. I think I have one more slide, Chris. I threw this slide in here because I know there was interest from the commission as well as the public. So the 2020 program there, you can see we spent around $131,000 with direct payments for tail submissions, had around $17,000 in salaries and benefits to administer this program, and about $1,000 of miscellaneous expenditures for a total of just shy of $150,000. Again, the commission did allocate $250,000 for the program, but you know, I think COVID-19 definitely played a pretty significant role in the decreased amount of participation, just because COVID hit right about the same time this thing started up, and I talked to a number of individuals that unfortunately weren't able to freeze their tails or get into an office during that time. And then I also talked to a number of individuals that thought that the decrease from the $10 to the $5 kind of was the threshold on people willing to participate or not. But those are some of the anecdotal comments that I heard from folks. With that, I believe that's my last slide, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? Sorry, I didn't hear. Whoever? I can't. If there's somebody trying to ask a question, you make a comment.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how clear this is coming over.
I can hear you.
Okay, but I guess my question is on the expense of the program, was that $16,900 in salary expense over and above our regular cost of labor, or is that just an allocation, the calculation of what the time spent on the program would be if we allocated those dollars to it?
So, Commissioner Sharp, you're correct that, you know, we have those employees that help man those check-in days and administer the program. If they weren't going to do that, they were going to do something else that day, so they were going to be paid. So this was just an allocation of time that staff spent on the activity. Does that make sense?
Oh, it does. Totally understand. I guess the reason I'm bringing it up is that it would be worth a discussion, certainly internally, as whether we want to continue to do that, because it artificially raises the cost of a program in the eyes of the public. One of the things we got roughed up on in the pheasant brood count was the estimated, you know, $90,000 in allocated expense, and then people were able to extrapolate out that if we don't want to do it, we must be worried about spending $90,000 to do it, when in fact that money is being spent anyway. It's just, as you pointed out, they're either spending their time on that or something else. So I'm not sure it's a fair representation of the cost of a program when we're looking at things. And like I say, that's more of an internal discussion. But if people aren't familiar with allocation of expenses, they're going to think that to do the program, we spent an additional $17,000 in employee expense that we didn't have to spend because of the program. So just an observation.
Yep, good point.
Other questions, comments?
Mr. Chair?
Commissioner Whitmire.
Yeah, thank you. Keith, that was a very good report. I'm impressed, I guess, with the COVID situation with how many people did turn in sales. I myself participated, I guess, outside of the program, but largely because I, you know, the freezer situation. So I thank those that participated and did that extra step of freezing the tails or what have you so that they could submit that for the bounty. And I expect there are probably others like me that probably participated but didn't turn in. Good job, and I think it's been very successful. Look, going forward, if we could look at the dates at which those tails were submitted, we'll not know, I guess, what was caught early on. But myself, I had a lot of success in April, and I just discontinued, I guess, right away because I got tired of checking traps that were empty, I guess. But if, with that, too, within 200 yards of the one location where I did my trapping, I've got 12 nests from mud hens to redhead ducks, blue-winged teal, that were successful. I can't say that was just because of the raccoon trapping, but removing 12 raccoons and the success of 12 nests of waterfowl plus what have you on everything else, I was impressed and happy that I had done that. But good report, and we'll keep watching for more.
Other questions, comments? Keith, if I remember your chart right, looked like there were, 176 kids, 17 and under, that participated?
That sounds right. I don't have it right up in front of me, but that sounds right.
Do we know how many of those were new to this trapping?
I could go back and we could see if they participated in the program last year. We wouldn't be able to tease out, of course, if they were new to trapping because individuals under the age of 16, of course, don't need to buy a license. So it would be hard to have any information in regards to that.
And then I think at least the biggest percentage of participants were, what'd you say, people 50 to 70?
51 to 70, yes.
Then when you had the statewide map up, it looked like there were several counties where the trapping was going on where there really are no pheasants. Is that fair?
Yeah, Chris, if you can go back, I think one or two slides, you could see the map here. There we go. What counties were you thinking about, Chairman?
Well, a lot of them in the West. I mean, you tell me, you would know better than I, but in Butte County, for example, or Lawrence County, or which just leads to my question, has there been any consideration to limiting this program if it continues to areas where there are pheasants?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think, that would be a discussion that we would have with you folks. And again, we came to you this past year in March and had you help craft, some of the parameters of the program. And moving forward for 2021, we would have a similar discussion. And if you folks felt that you wanted to carve out certain areas, we could talk about the pros and the cons, and ultimately you folks have the ability to make that decision. And I wish John Canta was on, Mr. Chairman. I'm sure that there is some pheasant habitat there in Butte and Lawrence counties, perhaps, along the Belfouche River where there's some agriculture activities, but I'm just not super familiar with that area. I do know that there's some robust pheasant populations in Perkins County and Dewey, Zeebach, Corson, Hawken, parts of Stanley, Jackson, Jones. So even though there were some lower numbers there, there's certainly some pheasant habitat and pheasant numbers in some of those areas, much more than we saw probably 20 years ago for sure.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Commissioner Spring.
One thing too, but these predators are really hard on the ducks and the turkeys nesting too, which is a you know, a real help to take these predators from that. In my area with all the turkeys, I know the predators really race heck with the nest.
All right, any other questions, comments? All right, thank you.